Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Real Sports Talk Radio, courtesy of FactSportsPage.com.
It's funny, for the last month that hasn't been going on, I was about to comment that we've missed the Randy Zellia intro, which just automatically runs on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, everybody. Seth and Sean, backsportspage.com, the post-Super Bowl extravaganza. Both of us a little under the weather, a little tired, a little just out of it. I think the weather in New York is doing that to everybody right now. This 35 and half rainy, half snowy, half crappy isn't going for me.
Well, I'll tell you one person that is definitely celebrating and is not under the weather, and that is Miss Jessica Fink. who is loving today. Today should be Jessica Fink Day, with her birthday coming up on Friday and her beloved Baltimore Ravens winning the Super Bowl. This is like Jessica Fink week.
Yeah, much love out to Jess and to all of my Ravens friends and fans. Having lived in Maryland for 10 years, half of my fraternity is from the Baltimore-Pikesville area. My Facebook wall was inundated, let's put it that way. And, of course, I watched the game with my one diehard San Francisco 49er friend, who is still complaining about the fourth down pass interference. Yeah, what was your thoughts on that?
Well, okay, Jim Harbaugh can bitch and moan all he wants, but he got the benefit of that call in the Atlanta game. So I don't want to hear – he wouldn't even be in the Super Bowl if not for the subjective holding calls or pass interference calls. I don't think it was pass interference. I think there was some grabbing on both sides. But, no, I mean, first of all, I don't think the ball was even catchable beyond anything else. I mean, the ball was thrown out of bounds. So I have yet to hear an analyst besides myself state that the ball wasn't even catchable. And if it's not catchable, the most you can get is a holding call, and I understand that, but there's no way you're going to get a pass interference call. Was it beyond the 5 yards? Yes. I mean, they started at the 5 yard line. This was in the end zone, so it's obviously beyond the 5 yards. But no. I mean, no. This is not a typical pass interference, no, absolutely not. I think Colin Kaepernick suffered a little bit of rookie jitters, or at least second-year jitters, and I think that he did not throw it to Randy Moss enough. I mean, believe it or not, Moss was open on most of those plays, and he decided not to throw it to him. The interesting stat that I saw was Kerry Williams, the guy that should have been thrown out of the Super Bowl in the first quarter, for shoving a referee, which is a whole other story in itself. He said that when they watched film, 50% of all throws into the end zone were to Michael Crabtree. 50%. That's a ridiculous stat. And for the defense to know that going in, you knew where that ball was going.
And to think about it, you know, one of the big points, I also agree with you. I did not think it was pass interference. I thought that was my first comment was the ball was uncatchable. I didn't like the play selection. I thought the third down screen, you know, almost like a 3 yard out to the five when you're on the 5 yard line was terrible. That they ran nothing really out of the pistol when they didn't run the ball at all in those four downs when they were. I mean, that Baltimore defense was exhausted. I thought Kaepernick actually looked, excuse me, except for the one really bad pass, I thought it looked very good. You know, Michael James fumbled, you know, was a potential 14-point turnaround early in the game. And it was a fun game. I don't think it was a great game. I'm happy for my Baltimore, for my Baltimore brethren. Flacco looked good. And yes, you know, the argument is Flacco elite. You know, I think everyone is a little bit sick of it. But the one thing you have to say is he was elite in this playoffs. You know, 11 touchdowns, no interceptions. I also thought And I don't like when I see, you know, you see the two teams during the media day. And, you know, Randy Moss makes comments about himself. Chris Culver makes incredibly stupid comments. You know, not that Baltimore is particularly, you can't really be a low-key team with Ray Lewis. But I think, Baltimore seemed like a more focused team going in. And they played like that prior to PB, prior to blackout.
I know that we have to talk about blackout at least for a little bit.
And can we just talk about Beyonce and Seth?
Yeah, well, not really, because Beyonce didn't have an effect on the game, but the blackout certainly did. I mean, I think it's even more interesting how fans of the NFL are criticizing the NFL for the blackout and whatnot. First of all, it's a power issue. It had nothing to do with the NFL. Let's understand that first and foremost. But the NFL lucked out. I mean, did it bring back the 49ers into the game? That's subjective. You could say it did or didn't. I'll tell you one thing. They're really lucky that didn't happen during a play. Like the 105, 106-yard run back. That the lights just all of a sudden didn't go out during the run. They were lucky on the timing of it. But it definitely did bring back or harken back to, and I'm sure Baltimore fans remember this, the blackout that happened at, I believe it was Memorial Stadium, when Cal Ripken may or may not have decided to play.
Or he may or may not have been in jail. But
right, or he may or may not have been injured, or Kevin Costner may or may not have slept with Cal Ripken's wife.
Oh, email back from Ms. Fink, 109-yard run back, not 106.
I don't believe it was 109. I think it was 108.
If anyone wants to call in and talk about this, our call in number 760-283-0846.
And Ms. Fink, you are more than welcome to call in and chastise me for 1 or 3 yards. Go ahead.
It was an interesting game. My thought would be down when you were down in the red zone, the last 2 minutes, the two receivers you would be looking for, Crabtree wouldn't have been one of them. One, as you said, would have been Moss. The other would have been Vernon Davis, who had a really good game. And going across the middle, you know, Ray Lewis had no chance of keeping up with him during that game. Ray, going out. I'm sorry.
If you were following us on Seth and Sean on Twitter, I was pretty much tweeting the entire game. And the interesting thing that I found out was that nobody could stop a tight end in this game. Dennis Pitta, Ed Dixon, and Vernon Davis in the first half had more than half the catches of the entire two teams. And they had over, I think it was 180 yards in the first half between the three of them. Nobody could stop a tight end. Not even Ray Lewis, Patrick Willis, or Navarro Bowman. And where was Navarro Bowman in this game? I mean, I don't recall hearing his name once in the game. I think Willis and Bowman definitely were underwhelming in this game.
It's interesting. You know, San Francisco has been known as, you know, this is, you know, pretty much a great defensive team. Well, I'll say something. In the last 6 games, they've let up over 30 points 4 times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is not a team that looked weak on the secondary. The third touchdown pass to Jacoby Jones was awful. That was an awful defensive play. And, you know, taking nothing away from Flacco or Anquan Boldin, who is just a man. That man is a beast. And, you know, this is not a great offensive team in Baltimore. Say what you want about Flacco. This is not a great offensive team. San Francisco made them look like a great offensive team.
Yeah, I mean, the secondary wasn't there. The linebackers were nowhere to be seen. And the front four, aside from Alden Smith late in the game, Justin Smith was nowhere to be found, and Justin Smith may be one of the top 3 or 4 defensive linemen in the NFL. And granted, he was suffering with an injury, which he just had surgery on, I think it was yesterday, actually, the day after the Super Bowl. They got no pressure, and when they did get pressure, they couldn't bring Joe Flacco down. He reminded me very much of Ben Roethlisberger in this game, where he got hit a lot and he got chased a lot, but he never went down. And if you can, I mean, if you're bringing blitzes, if you're the 49ers, and you can't bring the quarterback down, well, good luck to you. And that's exactly what happened. He basically picked that secondary apart.
Well, the best example of that was actually one of the passes to Bolden in the first second quarter, where he almost looked like he threw up a Hail Mary pass. I think it was to Bolden about 30 yards downfield, who had one-on-one coverage. And Bolden could be the strongest receiver in the NFL, and pretty much boxed him out and caught what looked like just a Hail Mary pass, an alley-oop pass.
Well, Michael Wilbon said this. He tweeted this during the game. Is there any more under, and this is before the game or during the game, is there any more underappreciated wide receiver in the NFL than Anquan Boldin? And I don't think there is. I mean, he's getting a lot of pub now, but before this game, he wasn't characterized. I mean, we talked about this all season. We said that the Ravens did not have elite offensive players outside of Ray Rice. Well, you know what? Anquan Boldin kind of played like an elite receiver during that game. He didn't kind of. He did. I mean,
he played like an elite receiver this entire playoff series, this entire playoff run. And the team is, you know, he's always been, when he was in Arizona, he was underappreciated. Having the great Larry Fitzgerald playing with him and Kurt Warner as a quarterback, he was the third name that would come up. And going to Baltimore, where you have a team led by Ray Lewis and Ed Reed, and on the offensive side, Ray Rice, you know, Boldin is not a guy who's really gotten the attention he deserved. That being said, the man came back from a broken face in 2 weeks, a couple of years back. He's as tough as they get, great hands, a former quarterback, actually, I believe, at Florida State, and has developed into a solid number one. Although I guess you don't really think of him as a number, you don't think of Baltimore having a number one receiver, but you know, he is that tough clutch guy. And, you know, you go from there. By the way, another email from Ms. Fink, Dennis Pitta is hot. So Dennis, if you're listening and want to call in and you want to set up with a spunky Jewish girl from Pikesville, I think Pikesville, maybe Randallstown, I forget. 760-283-0846. Yeah, that'll embarrass her a little bit. So going forward, you know, where do both teams go from here? Ray Lewis is supposedly retired, and I'll be thankful not to be having to read about him on ESPN or Sports Illustrated for the next 7 months anyway, I guess, until preseason starts. The Niners to me were the better team, but we said this in our pregame when both of us took Baltimore. The Niners were the more talented team, and Baltimore just kind of seemed to have that run about them. What did both teams, in your mind, what did both teams have to improve upon?
Well, the Niners better redo their secondary. Aside from Darren Goldston, who's their safety, who is a free agent but could be franchised again for the second straight year, they have to revamp the entire secondary. That is atrocious. Justice Smith needs to get healthy. But aside from that, they are definitely more poised to get back than Baltimore. They are younger. They have a better – in my opinion, they have a better defense going forward than Baltimore does. I think they might have a better offense than Baltimore does. Their line, both offense and defense, is probably in the top 5 to 10 in the league. They don't have many questions going forward. All of their young players, Justin Smith, Navarro Bowman, Patrick Willis, Golston, Golston could be franchised because they don't have anybody else that needs that. Crabtree, Colin Kaepernick, Frank Gore, they're all signed for next year, and they're under the cap. So, I mean, and we've said this many times before, when you have a quarterback earning $770,000, now to you, me, and every other working stiff, that's a lot of money, but in the NFL it's not, especially for a starting quarterback. You can do a lot with your cap. So Kaepernick's earning about $770,000 next year, and that team is poised for another run. And from what we saw of Jim Harbaugh, I don't think you're going to see anything less than that. Now let's look at Baltimore. Baltimore, the guys that they are $5 million under the cap right now, and that is without Joe Flacco on the cap. So Joe Flacco is going to get either $14.6 million, which is a franchise number, which means that some team, including the Jets or the Chiefs or the Raiders, could pony up two first-round picks and go get him. Now, granted, they'd have to pretty much mess up their own cap, and Baltimore does have the right of first refusal for that. Or they can give him what's called an exclusive rights free agent, make him an exclusive rights, which means that Baltimore is the only team that can sign him, but that means that they have to pony up. Now, this is elite status, Mr. Kamens, $20.6 million for a 1 year. You heard that right. 1/6 of the cap on one player. So the question is, which way do they go? So let's assume that they go the small way in $14 million. So now they're $20 million over the cap, and they have major cuts to make, including maybe Anquan Boldin at $5.5 million, Jacoby Jones at $3.5 million, Ray Lewis saves you $3.5 million, Ed Reed is a free agent, Paul Kruger is a free agent. Their linebackers are free agents, the guys behind Ray Lewis. They have a lot of work to do on that cap. Ozzie Newsome is amazing, and Eric DaCosta is an amazing lieutenant to Ozzie Newsome. But I don't think you're going to see Baltimore back next year in the Super Bowl, if not in the playoffs. I think they're the team that doesn't make the playoffs next year.
Well, the other big news, I should talk. What was your favorite commercial?
Well, my favorite commercial is anytime Joe Montana is in a commercial and it's not really Joe Montana, he makes it the best commercial. The Tide commercial was amazing. I mean, I thought, because I think it finally showed everybody that there are crazy people out there. All of us fans are crazy people. We have crazy superstitions. Yours was the goat, right? You like
the
goat?
God, no. No, mine was the GoDaddy Bar Raffaele kissing the geek, because it gives hope to all of us.
Oh, mwah.
So apparently, if she's still single at 40, she's going to go on J-Date. I can't wait. I could only imagine, knowing what the IMs of the 32-year-old Jewish populace of New York City get from the dirty old men, what do you think Bar Raffaele is going to get? Oh, good Lord.
How old is she now?
I have no idea. Surprisingly, I'm not really up to my pop gossip. I leave that to, everybody else. But I thought there were a couple commercials. The commercials they weren't quite as overwhelming for me. I found myself wishing for Bud Bull, but unfortunately we're long past that. There was one commercial I'm actually forgetting off the top of my head that I thought was really funny, but I don't even remember.
What was the worst commercial?
Oh God.
I'm thinking the Dodge commercial with the farmers.
The farmer commercial was not really meant for two Jews from New York City. I'm pretty sure that we were not their main demographic.
Dodge paid $2 million per 20 seconds for this commercial that's probably 2 minutes long. I'm like, please, fast forward.
It's 2 minutes long, but it only felt like 15 minutes.
Yeah, seriously. It felt as long as the blackout.
And, I mean, that it was... it was just, the commercial I really enjoyed? The Taco Bell commercial.
Oh, really?
Oh, with the 80-year-old guy getting the tattoo of gold black across his back? I thought that was hysterical.
Ladies and gentlemen, Seth Kamen's taste in commercials is, anyway.
Similar to his taste in everything else.
If you'd like to call in and harass Seth about his taste in commercials or taste in anything else, 760-283-0846. We know you're Deloitte. Accountants are out there. Come on in and spend your money or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, jeez. All right. The other big news in the NFL this week is the Hall of Fame selections. And it was a pretty difficult it was a pretty stacked group that they were picking from. And we ended up with seven selections headlined, and every one of these is kind of a, well, of the non-Veterans Committee players. And that's kind of, before we get to that, what are your thoughts on the Veterans Committee at this point? That they seems to be a mandate, you know, when you have, what, 5-10 years that you can be picked? I know it's 15 in baseball.
Yep.
Do we really need a Veterans Committee at this point?
Well, how else are we getting Curly Culpin? I mean, that's the best name in the Hall of Fame. But honestly, I think we do, because when you go, because remember, the Hall of Fame, you have the maximum amount of players you can put into the Hall of Fame in a given year is seven. Five,
yeah.
Moderns, two legends or veterans. And some of these veterans are like from the 50s and 60s, where they didn't get the same publicity that you do today. And I really do think that if you look in the past, it's not the quarterbacks that are getting in on the Veterans Committee, but it's more the offensive and defensive linemen, the guys that didn't put up stats. So I really think that the Veterans Committee does hold good value. Now, would I like it to be one veteran and one builder? Yes. I'd like it one veteran and one builder. That way guys like Bill Parcells and Eddie DeBartolo and Art Modell don't take away from the players. I think that's a big mistake, because right now there's going to be a huge buildup in the next 2 or 3 years as far as players, and deserving players are not going to be able to get into the Hall of Fame because of the maximum five people. I think it happened this year. I think there were lots of players that should have been able to get in that were not, such as Jerome Bettis and Will Shields.
Well,
let's
kind of go through a little bit of the players. There was a couple of big arguments. You were Michael Strahan versus Warren Sapp, possibly the best the best defensive end in the league at a point versus the best defensive tackle in the league for a point, or at least the most charismatic at both positions. It's very difficult to make a determination on who you would have taken first. I thought Sapp's upside was higher. I thought Strahan was better for a longer period of time. I probably would have taken Sapp, but for me, it was almost a 50-50 proposition.
I think the thing is, in the Hall of Fame now, at least for the next couple of years, is it's going to be battles between the same guy, two guys in the same position. And you saw that with Warren Sapp and Michael Strahan. There's no doubt in my mind that Warren Sapp was a better player. I think Michael Strahan was actually an overrated NFL player. And I know I'm going to get a lot of arguments from the Giants fans out there, but I really do. I don't think Strahan played the run particularly well. I think he definitely played the pass. I mean, he was an extreme pass rusher. But there's a guy that was an extreme pass rusher for the Jets and a guy from the Pittsburgh Steelers. Kevin Green's still on the ballot. And Mark Gastineau, who may be one of the best pass rushers of all time, is not going to get a sniff of the Hall of Fame. So let me finish. But the fact that Strahan won a Super Bowl definitely plays into this, no doubt in my mind. The fact that he is a charismatic player and charismatic persona definitely plays in my mind. And the fact that he played in New York definitely plays into it. And he wasn't a bad boy. So, I mean, I think that there's another player that's even better than Strahan that's not in the Hall of Fame, and that's Joe Klecko. So, I mean, I don't think Klecko was better than Warren Sapp, but the thing is that people forget about Klecko is he made All-Pro in three different positions along the defensive line. So I agree. I think Sapp was the much better choice. I have no problem with it. But I think you are going to see battles like this and the Chris Carter battle, which we'll get into in a second, that's going to permeate throughout the Hall of Fame voting selection process in the next couple of years.
Yeah, the other big debate, I think most of us assumed that Jonathan Ogden and Larry Allen were going to get in on the first ballot. The big debate, which has been discussed for years, is the Andre Reed versus Chris Carter versus Tim Brown discussion. And I was actually somewhat swayed in a different direction on this. Originally, I really thought about it. And, you know, Chris Carter gets the nod. And I actually, you know, in retrospect, kind of reading through some of the statistics and kind of thinking about it in a little bit of a different way, I don't think I would have taken him over Tim Brown. And here's my argument why. Chris Carter, obviously, great for, you know, great hands. You know, I think he retired with the second most catches, I think, at that point. You know, really was a phenomenal player. But I look at who Tim Brown played with. He played with nobody. Chris Carter had initially Jake Reed, who was a borderline all-star wide receiver on one end. Then he had Randy Moss. He also had quarterbacks, you know, good quarterbacks, not saying a great quarterback, but a good quarterbacks, Dante Culpepper, Randall Cunningham. I think he played with Warren Moon for a little while, you know, who's a Hall of Famer. You know, good, solid quarterbacks. Who did Tim Brown play with? James Jett? You know, his best, I think he had Rich Gannon for a year or two. You know, plus he had so he had no wide receiver help, no real running back help after the Marcus Allen, Bo Jackson first couple years. He ended up with 15,000 yards, about 1,100 catches, 100 touchdowns. Plus he did special, he returned 3,000 or 4,000 yards on special teams. You know, I think Tim Brown had a better, really had, was a better player.
Okay. Well, I'd make a couple, and I disagree with you, respectfully disagree with you, but still disagree with you. I think Chris Carter was a better player. I think Jake Reed was nothing special. I think Chris Carter made Jake Reed something special. I think you're right. Tim Brown did not have the quality of players in the system that Chris Carter did. You will get no argument from me. Tim Brown did play with Jerry Rice.
Jerry Rice at age 39.
Hey, Jerry Rice had more catches than Tim Brown that year.
And Tim Brown was like 36. I mean, we're talking the way end of their career. We're not talking 27-year-old Jerry Rice here.
Carter's way end of Chris Carter's career, Randy Moss?
No, not the way end. Carter played until what, 2000? Carter's second year of eligibility? Third?
Yeah, Carter's last year was with Miami.
I don't even remember that.
He played six games with the Dolphins. So
in what year?
I don't have that in front of me.
I'm going to look that up right now. Okay, so continuing while I look this up.
I guess the point is, you're right. You cannot control who you play with. But at the same point, I think Chris Carter made Jake Reed. I think Chris Carter made Steve Jordan, who was a great tight end. But Tim Brown played with quality players. I won't say he played with the same quality, but Chris Carter had many more catches, many more touchdowns, a better per catch yardage. So I don't see how Tim Brown was a better player. If you take in the fact that he won a Heisman, that certainly helps, but this isn't the College Football Hall of Fame. I think that Tim Brown definitely hurt himself last week when he spouted off about Bill Callahan. There's nothing in my nothing could dissuade me different. But I think Chris Carter was a better player. I think Andre Reed was a better player than Tim Brown. I think Tim Brown's the third on that totem pole. Do I think he gets in? Potentially. But next year he's got even a bigger task at hand than Marvin Harrison. So next year we'll have another big three.
The issue with Marvin Harrison, his off what do you call it?
Off the field.
off the field activities play a part.
Of course, to the bylaws, if Lawrence Taylor gets in, then Marvin Harrison sure is.
Yeah, but the thing is, obviously, Marvin Harrison has never actually been indicted for anything. So,
right.
You know, but his is much more serious. For those who don't know, there has been a lot of suspicion with him in regards to murders in Philadelphia over the last few years. I don't know anything more than that, but, you know, I know HBO has done some things on it. Showtime has done some things on it. Oh, okay. I just picked this up. Career numbers. Tim Brown in 17 seasons. 1,094 yards, 14,934 receiving yards, 100 receiving touchdowns.
Wait, how many catches?
What'd you say?
How many catches? Because you said yards.
1,094 catches.
Okay.
14,934 receiving yards.
Yep.
100 touchdowns. Then approximately 4,500 punt and kickoff return yards.
Okay.
Chris Carter, 1,101 receptions. So the receptions are the same. It's a 7 reception difference.
Okay.
13,899 yards. So Tim Brown has about 1,000, give or take, 1,000 yards more.
Just receiving or a combined?
Just strictly receiving.
Okay.
Now, the difference is Chris Carter has 30 touchdowns more.
Mm-hmm.
And then 244-yard kickoff returns, kick returns. Brown's quarterbacks, Jay Schrader, Todd Marinovich, Jeff George, Vince Evans. It wasn't until about – and then had Rich Gannon at the end of his career.
Jim Brown played a lot of years.
Well, I'm saying Tim Brown played 16 years, but these are some of his – well, we can go through the list of quarterbacks, but this is just some of them that I'm bringing up. Carter played with Cunningham, Brad Johnson, who was very solid, Dante Culpepper. I think it's arguable. I don't put Andre Reed at that level. I put him a half step behind. Again, yes, you can't really control who you play with. I understand that. But in a league where you – I think they've had, what, 4 Hall of Famers from that team already? 3 on the offensive side?
You're talking about
Kelly,
the Bills?
The Bills. Kelly, Thurman Thomas, Ken Hall. I think Ken Hall is a Hall of Famer.
Ken Hall, right. And Bruce Smith, yep.
So, you know, it will be interesting to see what happens going forward. Because I believe it's, you know, the guy who I would have liked to have seen gotten a little bit more consideration. I shouldn't say he got more consideration. I have no idea how much consideration he got within the final 13, is Aeneas Williams.
Yep, I agree. But he's another guy that you can't control what teams you play on.
Yeah, but it's a little bit easier on the defensive side. Because you're not specifically looking at statistics on the defensive side as much. You know, you're looking at, you know, you have interceptions, obviously, but there's not, you know, there's not the 12 different statistics for you to evaluate.
No, which I think makes it even harder that he played with such a crappy team.
Well, I think, yeah, but he was also, yeah, I think that's fair. He did play with a crappy, crappy team.
I mean, Aeneas Williams made a Super Bowl, but not with the team that he's known for.
No, well, he made it with the Cardinals.
No, I don't think he was on that team.
Then who did he make
the
Hall of Fame?
He made it to the Rams.
Really?
He was on Marshall Faulk's team. Check
that
out. Are you sure? In front of you. No, not 100% sure.
I'm looking it up right now. I don't remember that.
Well, Roethlisberger's Super Bowl with the Cardinals was after Aeneas retired.
That could be true. That would probably make sense.
Within the last 5 years, right?
Yeah. You're right. I honestly don't remember him on the Rams.
Yeah, he got traded for a second-round pick.
You remember that off the top of your head?
I do.
Wow. You're a little bit terrifying.
Ladies and gentlemen, the fountain of useless knowledge. For those that are 5'8 to 5'10... Brunette, that enjoy that, please give us a call. 7 to 7. 2 and 3.
What do you need a 5'10? What do you need a 5'10 girl for? Who are you kidding? If we have any 5'10 girls that are interested in a 5'8 guy, 760.
Hey, that's not fair.
760-283-0846. Oh, man.
I just smoked.
It happens every once in a while. Sean Palmer, the king of sporkle, ladies and gentlemen. And no, that's not as gross as it sounds. Check it out. Fun website. You're right. Aeneas Williams, 8-time Pro Bowl, 4-time All-Pro, 90s All-Decade team. Good call. I completely forgot that he played with the Rams.
Yeah. Well, the last guy that was inducted into, or will be inducted into the Hall of Fame has a little bit of a local flavor, and that is one Bill Parcells. And I don't have an argument with him at all. I mean, I think he's a Hall of Famer. He had a 57.1% winning percentage. He took 4 teams to the playoffs, 3 to the championship game, resurrected, brought 2 to the Super Bowl, won 2 Super Bowls. Yeah, I don't have a problem with it. And again, you're going against other personnel, such as Eddie DeBartolo or Art Modell, where Art Modell, unfortunately, I don't think will ever get in, because I think that there's too much animosity from the Cleveland faithful. And DeBartolo, well, he was an amazing owner, but he kind of took a bribe, or gave a bribe, and thus you kind of have to take that into account too. So I don't have a problem with Parcells, except for the fact that I don't believe that a builder should take away a spot from a player.
No. I think you're right. And, you know, as the league is expanding, there's more and more, you know, players of that, you know, could be willing. And again, I always say could be because, you know, as you know, I am of Hall of Fame. You know, for me, the argument is always, you know, I want a Hall of Great, not a Hall of Very Good.
Well, hold on a second. Who in the 15? Because I assume that they're not going to be anybody else but the 15. Who in the 15 would make the Seth Kamens Hall of Fame?
Actually, a lot of these guys would.
Okay, who?
Parcells. I'm going through the list right now.
So Parcells is elite, having only won 2 Super Bowls.
And having gone to another and revitalized 1 or 2 other franchises? Yeah, he's elite.
Okay.
I was saying Chris Carter is a Hall of Famer. Chris Carter was one of the top 3 receivers in football. Aeneas Williams, I think, is elite. Are you laughing?
No, I'm listening.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
I think in that list, you know, top 3 or 4 cornerbacks in football for a significant period of time. Warren Sapp, defensive lineman. Top defensive tackle in football for a decent number for several years. Jonathan Ogden, Larry Allen, top offensive line, top 3 offensive linemen for a significant period of time. Tim Brown is an argument. Jerome Bettis is an argument.
Wait a second. Tim Brown. I'm sure you have Tim Brown's stats still up. Okay.
Yep.
Tim Brown ever make the All-Pro team?
I'm going to look it up right now.
Because I don't think he did. I mean, All-Pro team is voted on by the players and voted on by management, not by people like you and me. And if he doesn't make an All-Pro team ever, then he's not, to me, elite. There are only two or three All-Pro wide receivers at any given time.
Right, and he never made the first team.
Okay, so how is that elite?
A 9-time All-Star, 9-time Pro Bowl,
but
which, again,
time,
is a Pro
Bowl. Remember, the Pro Bowl is very
I know, I understand.
Pundits like you and me.
When David Gerrard makes a Pro Bowl, I guess, you know, the arguments, no, I understand that. I think...
I'm not sure Chris Carter ever made an All-Pro team. I don't know, but I know Marvin Harrison certainly did.
You know, let's look up Chris Carter. God bless Wikipedia.
I mean, that's where I go. And I know Warren Sapp made all pro teams. And I know that Strahan did. And I know Aeneas Williams did. So, and Ogden and Allen basically dominated the all pro teams in the 90s.
Yeah.
The early
Chris Carter had made two first team all pro, one second team all pro.
Okay.
And was an 8-time Pro Bowl selection.
But I think that's where I would have to, if you're going to go in the Seth Kamens Hall of Fame, and we will be erecting that in Wayne, New Jersey at some point. we in the basement of his parents' house. We need parameters beyond he's just the best of, or he's one of the top three. If he's one of the top three, then people had to have voted him one of the top three.
Well, I guess I have a little bit more leeway in football, and I don't have a reason. I don't have a rationale for it for football than I do for baseball. I can't give you a specific. I can't give you. I'd have to think about it a little bit.
We have 20 minutes. Figure it out. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that's not gonna happen. you know, I have a little bit more leeway. You know, it's very difficult for me. You know, I'm not a scout. I'm not a game analyst. It's hard for me to analyze offensive linemen. I can't do it. I can see certain things. I know Jonathan Ogden had a year where he let up. He had one sack and two holds. Doesn't take a brain surgeon to realize that's pretty sensational.
Here's the interesting thing about Jonathan Ogden, which I read the other day. In his career, and I believe I'm reading this correctly, he had 13 holding penalties. In his entire career. There are guys on the Jets and Giants that have that in a season. I think Doug Free had that this season for the Cowboys.
I think Doug Free may have had that in a four-game stretch.
Right.
Heck, he may have had that in the Giants game against.
I think he also only had 13 offside penalties. For an offensive tackle, that's amazing. That's elite.
Yeah.
So, great. I mean, you're right. It's hard to judge offensive and defensive linemen because stats are, especially a defensive tackle like Warren Sapp. I mean, if you put Warren Sapp on the outside and made him a defensive end, would he have had 120 sacks? It's possible. He was definitely that athletic.
Yeah, I mean, there's a definitive greatness that you can see in a defensive lineman. John Randall was a phenomenal, was an elite defensive lineman.
Kanodi Nata. When Nata came out of that game on Sunday, you noticed that the 49ers could all of a sudden run up the middle. I mean, his absence was definitely felt. I think he's an elite defensive lineman.
The funny thing also about Ogden, and then we'll kind of – if any, the probably one of the best sports books I've ever read, and I've read quite a few, was a book by John Feinstein called Next Man Up, where they did a year in the life of the Baltimore Ravens, the year actually Steve Biscotti took over it's around 2003, 2004. And they talk a lot about Ozzie Newsome. And they say how Newsome made his career, that the entire team, you know, the organization wanted to draft Lawrence Phillips, the running back from Nebraska, at number four. The one place that Ogden did not want to go, had no interest particularly in being, and was, I don't even think he was interviewed by them, was Baltimore. And Newsome pretty much overtook Modell, Art Modell, who was the owner, the coaches, so on. So I think Billick, if I remember correctly. Oh, no, not Billick. The coach before him, I forget who it is. And
Ted,
you know, Lawrence
Walter Phillips.
Bush. Could have been. Was it? It could have been.
I
don't
think
remember.
So.
Lawrence Phillips, of course, ended up in jail. And
he wound up going number six to the Rams.
Right.
While Ogden went number four to the Ravens.
Yes. And then also in that draft, they took Ray Lewis, who, in case you haven't heard, he announced his retirement. I heard a couple people, I know a couple people made some, you know, that was in a,
and
was a new
thank God a couple of times, too. But no more than Ed Reed. Ed Reed thanked him more.
Yes. So, Probably, got about 15 minutes left. Everyone wants to talk. It's kind of that post Super Bowl doldrum right now. The one thing we do want to talk about is, as our resident salary cap, our capologist, you want to explain for people who are wondering, and I had this talk actually with Jared Zwirling from ESPN.com, off the radio, although he was on last week, and we hope to have him on again soon, about the Rudy Gay trade. Rudy Gay, the all-star, borderline all-star play, small forward from Memphis, being traded to Toronto. And them getting a lot of little pieces.
It was
back.
A three-way deal, and we're going to see a lot. We're going to see a lot of trading in the next couple of weeks, at least from what I see. And Toronto tried to revitalize their team by swinging a trade with the Memphis Grizzlies, where they traded Jose Calderon, who was their point guard, to Detroit. Detroit then swung Austin Day. Oh, I'm sorry. It was Jose Calderon and Ed Davis went from Toronto. Detroit added Austin Day and who am I missing? There's one guy.
Maurice Wright.
No.
Are you talking who Memphis? Who Memphis added?
Keyshawn
Prince.
Wright was in the earlier deal. To
Keyshawn Prince.
Keyshawn Prince, thank you. Sprites went to the Cavaliers in the earlier deal. So Keyshawn Prince and Austin Day went over to the Memphis Grizzlies along with Ed Davis. Jose Calderon went to Detroit, and Rudy Gay went to Toronto. And the reasoning for all this was because while Memphis was under the cap due to the Marcus Sprites deal, they were just barely under the cap. And they have a lot of salaries coming up. Mike Conley, Hamilton. Wow, I can't remember. Zach Hamilton. I almost called him Zenden. Zach Hamilton and Marc Gasol all take up about $16 million in each for the next couple of years. So they would have had no flexibility. Detroit put themselves in a great position of having Calderon's on a one-year deal. He expires this year. He earns $10 million. And they got rid of Keyshawn Prince's two-year $14 million deal in the next couple of years. And Rudy Gay gets off that Memphis cap at $19 million a year and goes to Toronto. So Memphis and Detroit make out like bandits. And I think with DeMar DeRozan up in Toronto, well, I don't know what Toronto's doing, because, again, now they have a superfluous amount of small forwards and power forwards, and they have no backcourt except for Kyle Lowry. So here we go again with Toronto trying to remake themselves in no apparent way whatsoever.
But here's the question. Yes, Memphis takes gets $20 million off their cap. Memphis was a title contender prior to this. Maybe not at the top level, but I don't think anyone would have been shocked to see them make the NBA Finals with the way the team is built for the playoffs. They're tough defense. They're well coached. The one thing they don't do well is score. By trading your best scorer, yes, you're going under the cap, but are you sacrificing a shot at the championship here?
Well, remember last year, they played very well without Rudy Gay anyway. Rudy Gay was shooting about 45% from the field, which is exactly what they don't need. They got a guy named Keyshawn Prince who plays extremely good defense and can shoot about 45%. Is he as athletic as Rudy Gay? No. But they also get a great front court rotation with Ed Davis, who's come on superbly this year. Are they a title contender? I don't think they were a title contender before the trade. I really don't. I don't think the lack of Rudy Gay makes them any less or more of a title contender. I think they pretty much stayed in neutral. They didn't improve or disprove their team. I think that the Raptors, if any team improved their team for today, it's the Raptors, but they got now three guys that are all wing people that all shoot under 50%. That should not happen.
Well, every wing player shoots under 50%. That's not, most of them do. That's not really a shock.
Okay, fair enough. I don't think that I think the Raptors are going in a circle. I never think that they have any direction whatsoever. I think the team that came out the best in this was Detroit, who rid themselves two more years of Tayshaun Prince's contract, and all they had to give up was Austin Day, who really didn't fit into their plans anyway.
Fair enough. That's why I keep him around, folks. We got about 10 minutes left.
Because I know Aeneas Williams was traded for a second-round pick.
Yeah, my damn memory, too many Bud Lights over the years, Miller Lights. But I just don't remember that for some reason. So we got about 10 minutes left. So what are you thinking right now? What do you want to talk a little bit about?
Well, I'm thinking I definitely heard something today that kind of surprised me, and you can take it as you wish. But so Dwight Howard was on an interview with Stephen A. Smith, and Stephen A. Smith asked him this very question. So how does it feel when you've taken 457 shots this year, and I think it was 457, it could have been anywhere in the 450, and Kobe Bryant's taken 1,100. How does that make you feel? Now, understand the fact that Dwight Howard's missed a lot of time. Well, he actually really hasn't. He's missed probably 10 games. But Dwight Howard's supposed to be a superstar who is not taking any shots. Do you really think that Dwight Howard's staying in a Laker purple and gold after this year? I know we've gone through this year in, year out, but I think it's really a legitimate possibility that he doesn't do it.
I had this discussion last week, and we really came up, or actually I had it yesterday. We came up with, you know, there was four teams that made sense. Dallas, who will be severe, because having signed so many of these players on one-year deals, should be pretty well under the cap next year. Atlanta, who has cleared out everything, and they're going to have an interesting place with re-signing Josh Smith, who happens to be Dwight Howard's best friend, or one of his closest friends. And Howard is from Atlanta. And one of the other guys talked about him going to Houston. Although I don't particularly know the salary cap situation of Houston at this point. But I think they're pretty low as well. The fourth, obviously, being rejoining the Lakers. Now, if you go to Houston or you go to Dallas, you know, there's no state income tax. You're saving some change. You know, you're saving some good change there. Yes, and yes, that's the advantage of having CPA
change
run
to him and a four-year salary to you and me.
So, you know, those were the four choices that make sense. He still made a comment about Brooklyn, which I can't believe because, first of all, Brook Lopez, as strange as it sounds, has been just about the best center outside of Joaquin Noah in basketball this year, which sounds strange to say, but it's pretty much true. He's not going to Brooklyn. His value is diminished as a trade asset, or just isn't that high because obviously he would have to be re-signed, and we're seeing the issues, you know, that are going with that. I don't know. I think he stays with the Lakers. I think he likes. I think he likes the atmosphere of it. I don't think. I shouldn't say I think he likes it. I don't. I think he wants to be the center of attention in a big city. That's, you know, that's what he wanted. I'm gonna hold it to his word. That's what he wants. But, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Kobe is there for one more year at least. Paul Gasol is still going to be there because I think that he has absolutely no trade value right now. So Steve Nash is going to be there for at least two more years. I can't see them trading him either. So the question is, where do they go? And there's another interesting scenario brewing, and that's in Boston. And we talked about this last week, but I think it's even more pressing right now because they were banking on the young Jared Sullinger coming through, and now Jared Sullinger is out for the entire year too. So is it time to break up the Celtics?
Well, the trade rumor that's been going around, and honestly it's confused me a little bit, is to the Clippers for Eric Bledsoe and Caron Butler.
Now, that's Kevin Garnett.
Kevin Garnett, I'm talking about. Now, with Rajon Rondo out for the year, now you have to think about, I mean, my thought process is, number one, the Clippers, you know, Chris Paul has been possibly been the MVP when healthy. He hasn't been healthy the whole year. And for him to be, and also for Bledsoe to be, you know, for them to remain, you know, Bledsoe's been very solid. So I don't know if you really want to trade your point guard if your point guard, your backup point guard, if your point guard has been healthy, been hurt the whole year, on and off, I should say. Number two, why exactly are the Celtics going to do? They just re-signed Rondo to a 5-year deal. And, you know, considering how people seem to be coming off the torn ACLs, I'm not quite convinced that he won't be back pretty solid next year. Caron Butler is, for all intents and purposes, a dime. I don't want to say a dime a dozen. You know, he's a nice wing player, but there's nothing you look at him and say he's spectacular. Why would this deal make sense?
Well, this deal doesn't make any sense from the Celtics. I mean, if that's the rumor, the Bledsoe is going to come back next year with Rondo, and him and Avery Bradley and Rondo would be great perimeter backcourts defensively, but offensively they provide almost nothing. Losing Garnett's rebounding ability, unless the Celtics were ready to trade Paul Pierce too, and seeing that, that would make sense. Caron Butler, you're right, dime a dozen. If they were getting DeAndre Jordan, that would be a different story, because DeAndre Jordan would actually be able to play the center position. The interesting thing here is that Kevin Garnett is one of four people in the NBA that have no trade clauses. So if Kevin Garnett doesn't want to go anywhere, Kevin Garnett's not going anywhere. And he said today he bleeds green. So I bleed orange, he bleeds green, you bleed red. We all have our little shticks.
I'm sure the Timberwolves are thrilled to hear that. All right, we got 3 minutes to go. You want to finish up?
No, I want you to. Go right ahead.
All right, what am I going to finish with? Damn, I got to have something. No, wait, not until next week. To me, it's funny. The best sporting event actually of this weekend was not the Super Bowl. Yes, I'm going for the obscure sports again. Was the UFC super fight, Jose Aldo, Frankie Edgar, for the 145 title. You know, MMA has made such huge runs in the last couple of years, although last year was kind of stagnant due to all the injuries. The reality is this: unless you get some real judges, and not boxing judges who are coming over from the boxing commission in Nevada, get some MMA judges, figure out a standard, set it up, run it right, the sport can never be taken that seriously. And, you know, Frankie Edgar has been in seven consecutive title fights, and the last five of the seven were disputed ending decisions. I thought he won. The people I watched with thought he won. The press thought he lost by a point. Figure out a standard, stick to it, and let's get this thing, try and get this thing running correctly, because until it is, it will be in a lot of ways a joke to the casual fan.
All right. Well, we were talking about hot women before, and just think, notwithstanding, Lindsey Vonn today. Could there be any professional or amateur athlete that is more cursed than Lindsey Vonn? And that is not because she supposedly is dating Tiger Woods, although you may want to check the ex-wife, because who knows, she does a wicked thing with a golf club. But anyway, Lindsey Vonn,
hey-o.
For those that did not know today, went down the ski slope and tore her ACL, her PCL, and fractured her tibia in her right leg. There is no more devastating injury outside of Dante Culpepper that I have ever heard to a leg. And for somebody that has had his share of knee injuries, I cringed. With 1 year to go till Saki, not the drink, Sochi, in Russia next year for the Olympics, does Lindsey Vonn have it in her to go one more round with the rehab and see if she can come back strong? For all those people that enjoy watching skiing, and I actually enjoy it, I don't enjoy performing it, probably because it is one of the very many sports that I absolutely suck in, you have to be rooting for Lindsey Vonn. So here's to a speedy recovery and a good surgery and a good surgeon, because that knee is very valuable. For Seth Kamens, this has been Sean Palmer. We had fun as usual. Thanks to all the listeners, to the Detroit, the Lake people, And, of course, to the lovely Jess Fink, we will see you next week.
Night, everybody.